So, welcome to Hinduism 2. We'll be kind of building on what we've done in Hinduism, in Hinduism 1. If you haven't done Hinduism 1, I'm sure you'll be able to catch up fairly quickly, or I'm sure you've done it in elsewhere. And really what we'll be doing this term is looking at the different traditions that arise, the different traditions that are still important and influential in Hinduism today, that have arisen over many centuries, that are concerned with all the texts that we've been looking at in last term in Hinduism 1. And so we'll see that different traditions focus on different texts, develop different theologies based on that, and have a very different view of what religious practice consists of. But before we get into each of the individual traditions, there's a few sort of general things that I want to highlight of some things that they all have in common that perhaps might help us sort of navigate and place the other traditions when we see them in greater detail. And the first is that every tradition we'll be looking at is really concerned with freedom. And it's a very characteristic element of Hindu traditions and Indian thought more generally, that the ultimate concern is not the good, as you find, for example, in a lot of Western thought, starting with the Greeks, but is rather the concern about freedom. And freedom is interpreted variously, as we will see. Freedom can mean freedom from this world, from the cycle of rebirth that we are in this world. It can mean attaining a state of liberation that is beyond this world, where you're not bound by your actions, where you're not bound by ignorance, where you're not bound by the elements of this world. But it can also mean a state of freedom in the sense of being in this world, but having greater freedom in this world and having power over this world, and being able to control things in greater ways than an ordinary human being is possible. We'll see when we look at tantric traditions, a lot of tantric traditions are concerned with the latter, with attaining a freedom within this world, whereas Vedantic traditions, for example, that we will be starting with, they're more concerned with freedom from this world rather than a freedom within this world. And part of that too, then, if they're concerned about freedom, one of the other things they all have, the tradition that we'll be looking at, have in common is there are some fundamental principles that they share in the way they look at the human person, at ourselves, at us, where all the traditions that we'll be looking at are taking some ideas from the Upanishads regarding the nature of the self as being distinct from the body that we inhabit, as being distinct from the temporary identities that come with the body that we have, and therefore, and it's kind of connected to this quest of freedom, because then understanding the self leads to a state of freedom from the entanglements that come with the body, and so there is this it's understanding the nature of the self is that which will lead to a freedom from suffering, whether that freedom is understood as freedom from this world or freedom within this world. And as long as we have not attained that, we are subject to rebirth and the suffering and the joy that comes with that. And so the bodies that we inhabit, the mind that we possess, these are temporary things that will come and go with the birth and death, but they're to be used in a certain way to lead to that ultimate freedom. And this is a notion that's very important in Hindu thought, is that there are certain things that you will have to do then in response to that quest for freedom, or in order to attain that freedom. There are certain practices you will engage in, whether that's ritual practices, whether that's meditational practices, whether that's a total abandonment to the will of God, as we will see some traditions see it. But there is a practice that these various traditions will prescribe that is something that you will have to do again and again every day for the rest of your life. You engage in sort of a deepening of that practice, which is often called sadhana. Sadhana is literally sort of the means, the thing that leads to the sadhya, to the goal. And so there's a strong emphasis on practice, on not just understanding, even traditions that emphasize the importance of understanding the nature of reality, understanding the self, and so on. They will still emphasize that there is a certain practice that you should do for, you know, every day of your life, that you should engage in, because that is that which will lead you to come to understand the truths that are taught in your tradition. As we will see, what that practice involves varies greatly from tradition to tradition, and even within the tradition, within individual traditions, there is differences of opinion in some cases. This is a very important element of them, and it kind of goes back to the question of whether Hinduism is a religion that, or sort of a group of religions that is concerned with orthodoxy or orthopraxy. Is it about correct belief, or is it about correct practice, the doing the right thing? And we will see that sort of the traditions we look at this term are kind of in between the two. On the one hand, there is a lot of them have a great emphasis on doctrine, on understanding things in the proper way. But at the same time, a lot of them will emphasize the importance of practice. And some traditions will even argue that even though doctrine is important, practice will have its effect even if you do not have a correct understanding of the doctrine that tradition teaches. So keep this in mind, that because the emphasis that we in the coming weeks will be on theology, and because there is more to say about it, but keep this in mind that all of these traditions do emphasize practice, and expect the adherents of that tradition to engage in that. Now, all of these, or many of these traditions, see themselves, or many of these traditions are traditions that stress initiation, that stress the importance of being initiated in a particular tradition. And it's the moment of initiation is very important for these traditions, not just because then it signals that you belong to that particular tradition and it's sort of a social marker of, oh, this person is an adherent of this tradition, but it's also an important moment for most of these traditions because that marks the beginning, as it were, of your sort of spiritual path within that tradition. Because what happens for most of these traditions at the time of initiation is it's the initiation kind of marks the transmission of doctrines and of theology and your acceptance of the doctrines and the theology of the tradition you're initiated in, but also of the ritual practice that is taught by that tradition. And this is important because, as we will see, some traditions argue that, or quite a few argue that, what they're teaching is not the only truth, in a sense. So they will say, this is the ultimate truth, this is the deepest understanding about the nature of God, the nature of the self, and so on, is presented in this tradition. But other traditions are not entirely wrong, and other traditions do have some elements of truth in them. And particularly when it comes to practices, a lot of the traditions will argue that we have this practice, but this is not the only way, and there's other practices that you can perform as well. But by taking initiation into this tradition, you agree to basically follow these practices that are codified and sort of in our tradition and that are set down and passed on from generation to generation. So in a sense, the traditions that we'll be talking about are traditions that require quite a serious commitment from the practitioners. And we know that not everyone belongs to a tradition, just as today not everyone belongs to one of the traditions that we will be talking about. But it's kind of hard to, when you sort of look at the past, there's little record of people that do not belong to traditions. It's mostly what we know of the past is the writings of theologians who belong to specific lineages and who prescribe their theology and their practices and so on. And so it's kind of what we have of the past is kind of in a sense sort of the religious elite, if you want. Whereas what the common people might have done, we know to some degree through inscriptions and so on, and through references in other writings. But anyway, that's kind of one of the limitations we have about thinking about the past. All right. Now today I want to start by looking at one of the most influential traditions, and that is the tradition of Advaita Vedanta. And the principal theologian of that is a person called Shankara, about whom we know relatively little. As is the case with pretty much every author we'll be looking at in the coming weeks, he makes little or no reference to himself in his text, so we kind of do not get to know a lot about him in his texts, which is the standard in sort of intellectual works in India. Occasionally, you kind of, particularly in more recent centuries, you get authors at the end who kind of give a family lineage of themselves, and we can sort of glean something from it. But often that's not done. There are accounts of his life that are written by sort of later persons in the tradition that he founded, but they're considerably later, and there's some sort of question marks you can sort of put in the margin of those accounts. Partly because Shankara becomes a very influential figure, as sort of the person of Shankara becomes immensely influential after centuries after his life, and he's often invoked by various traditions or by various groups as sort of belonging to them, and you find a lot of texts that are written later on that are ascribed to him as a way of sort of giving more authority and more validity to the teachings of those texts. A lot of these texts deal with topics that Shankara, as far as we know from what we can sort of safely say were his works, as far as we can sort of tell what Shankara was thinking from those works. A lot of those ideas that these later texts say were ideas that Shankara would never even dream of stating, but he becomes a very influential figure, and therefore a lot of later authors kind of align themselves with him, particularly as later on different traditions align themselves with Advaita Vedanta, and then sort of in order to make that link stronger, often the alignment is for political reasons, and then to make that alignment stronger, there are certain texts that are then ascribed to Shankara as sort of teaching the for example, there are certain tantric traditions that become associated with Advaita Vedanta, and you get certain tantric texts that are then said to be have been written by Shankara to kind of make that that link more plausible. What we do know is that he likely lived in the 8th century. Some say a little earlier, some say a little later, but sort of roughly that period. And that he wrote a number of commentaries on the principal Vedantic texts. Now, the principal Vedantic texts are the Upanishads, as we've seen. They are the Vedanta. They present themselves as the Vedanta, as the final word of the Vedas. And then on a text called the Brahma Sutras, which is a text that's very hard to date, but is essentially a study of the Upanishads that attempts to codify, sort of outline how you should read the Upanishad, how you should see the Upanishads as teaching a coherent message. And then finally, the Bhagavad Gita, this episode in the Mahabharata, which is seen as the Upanishad of the fifth Veda, that is the Mahabharata. And so basically these become the three foundations for Vedanta. Shankara writes commentaries on all of them, it's as well as a few independent treatises where he outlines his theology. And it's from those writings that we can sort of gather his thought. There's a lot of other writings ascribed to him, as I said, but it's generally agreed that the commentaries on these texts are his. There's a few independent works as well, but apart from that, most of the other ones are later works. Now, one of the difficulties that we have with Shankara is that Shankara is both a very clear thinker and a very lucid sort of his writing is very lucid. He has one could almost say the uncanny ability of explaining very complex ideas in very simple terms. He's very easy to read, and contrary to some later Vedantic authors who are very difficult to read. But on the other hand, he's also very difficult. He's very difficult because the ideas he teaches are quite radically different from ideas that are found in other Vedanta schools. But he's also different because he seems to be inconsistent in a number of places. And various scholars have dealt with this variously. Some have argued that we see a sort of a trajectory of his thought in his writings, and that's sort of we see that certain ideas are sort of developed as he grows older, which, by the way, he didn't. Tradition says that he died very young. He died by around your age, and so everything he did before that time. But anyway, so some scholars have argued that the inconsistencies we see in his thought are due to sort of his maturity, his maturing of his ideas. Some have argued that the inconsistencies in his thinking come from him being a commentator on other texts, and that essentially, since he sort of the majority of his works are commentaries, that he explains certain things insofar as they're taught in those texts and then sets them out. Others have argued that the inconsistencies are really not inconsistencies if we look at them as ways of teaching his sort of students as a way of thinking about a certain thing. And so the end goal is not the way how you get to the conclusion, but rather sort of the conclusion itself in a way. It's sort of meant to kind of help you to grasp the ideas that he's teaching. And we'll see some of this as we look a bit more closely at Shankara's ideas. The other difficulty we have with Shankara is that we have Shankara's writings, and Shankara's writings form the foundation for the school of Advaita Vedanta, or we should say the schools of Advaita Vedanta, because there's a number of sort of schisms that occur within the tradition. And we kind of have the Shankara of the text, and we have the Shankara of the tradition. There are certain ways in which Shankara has been read over the centuries that are fairly consistent, but that both scholars and practitioners, contemporary Advaitins, have sort of said, hold on, this is not actually what Shankara was saying. And the way he has been interpreted, the way he has been read from his direct disciples onwards, some have argued is not actually a representative of Shankara's own ideas, and there's a lot of extra ideas that have sort of been added to him. It's something that makes it a bit more complicated too in sort of figuring out where he actually stands on things, because everyone who reads Shankara kind of comes to Shankara with a certain presuppositions about him that come from 12 centuries of engagement with Shankara's works, both in his own tradition as well as by opponents of Shankara. So keep that in mind when we look at him. as I said, though, Shankara is a very, very lucid author. He's very clear. He's very concise in his explanations of things. But there's a reason his writings have become so popular and led to this sort of this enormous flowering of sort of Advaitic thought that you see in the tradition in the authors that come after him. Now, Shankara has also said, apart from being a theologian and explaining the theology of Advaita Vedanta, he's also credited by the tradition as the organizer of an ascetic community into different monasteries and into different orders. And those are claims, again, that are made by the later hagiographical literature, and there is little sort of evidence to prove that that was actually the case. We don't know whether it was or wasn't. What we do know is that the references to the different orders that he's said to have started generally come much after he lived. But anyway, tradition sees him as not just a thinker, but also an organizer of the tradition into distinct monasteries with distinct orders throughout the Indian subcontinent. Now, what does Shankara actually teach? Shankara is a teacher of Advaita, and Advaita is non-dualism. And this is really the core of his teachings. He argues there is only one reality, and the one reality is that which is taught by the Upanishads, which is Brahman. And Brahman for him is non-dual in two senses of the term. It is non-dual in the sense that within Brahman there is no duality, and so within Brahman there is not sort of any division or any multiplicity of any sort. Brahman is one and undivided, which means for him that Brahman has no attributes, because if you introduce attributes, you have the possessor of attributes and the attribute itself, and that would create a duality. Where Shankara argues, Brahman is non-dual, as the Upanishads claim, therefore Brahman cannot have any attributes. Brahman is a state of consciousness, pure consciousness, and the Advaita tradition itself kind of struggles with this and sort of has different ways of thinking about this, some kind of go to sort of say, okay, well, if Brahman has no attributes, can we then therefore say anything about Brahman? If Brahman has no attributes, what about the attribute of being? Is that not an attribute, and so on? And you have various, or even consciousness, is that not sort of a property of Brahman then? And you have various Advaitin thinkers who deal with that very differently. Some argue that basically Brahman is entirely ineffable. We cannot say anything about Brahman. We cannot think about Brahman. We can only experience Brahman. And the attributes that seem to be ascribed to Brahman in the Upanishads and so on are just means of helping us to sort of meditate on it as means of negating the false conceptions of Brahman. Some Advaitins, particularly sort of in the 14th century onwards, take a slightly different approach and say, no, there are things we can say about Brahman, but we can never fully understand the nature of Brahman in possessing these things. But the other important part of Brahman being Advaita or non-dual is that Brahman is non-dual in the sense that Brahman is not part of something of a duality. And so there is not something here is Brahman and here is something that is not Brahman. That would be a duality. But Brahman is non-dual also in that sense that it is not part of a duality. And so Brahman is the only reality, and everything else that exists there is nothing else that exists because Brahman is non-dual. If Brahman is is consciousness, is a state of pure consciousness, and is the only thing that exists and is non-dual, there's no division within it. The difficulty we have is that this is not our experience. Our experience is that we perceive things to be other than consciousness. We perceive the world around us as being different from its inert, there is no consciousness in it. We perceive a multiplicity of selves, different, you know, you have consciousness, I have consciousness, but I'm not conscious of what you're conscious of, and so on. And so our experience is very different from that. And this is, Shankara argues, due to what he calls superimposition. And superimposition is really the key idea of his theology, where he argues that our experience in this world is of our experience of ourselves is of the nature of superimposition. We superimpose the qualities or the nature of something onto something else. And the standard example is of the snake and the rope, where you have a rope, and we perceive, say, you know, there's a rope in this room, and we come in at night when it's a little dark and we don't perceive clearly, and I perceive that the rope in the corner of the room, but I think it is a snake. And so what I've done is I've superimposed the notion of a snake onto the rope and perceive a snake where there's actually only a rope. And so in the handout, you have a little excerpt from the beginning of Shankara's commentary on the Brahma Sutras, where he deals with this notion of superimposition. It's sort of the thing he starts with. And if you look to the sort of bottom of the first column, it says there, this superimposition is considered by the learned to be avidya, or ignorance, and the ascertainment of the real entity by separating the superimposed thing from it is called vidya, or knowledge. This being so, whenever there is superimposition of one thing on another, the locus is not affected in any way, either by the merits or demerits of the thing superimposed. All forms of worldly and Vedic behavior start by taking for granted this mutual superimposition of the self and the non-self, known as ignorance. And so do all scriptures dealing with injunction, prohibition, and emancipation, liberation. Now, what he's stating there is that this superimposition, where we identify with the body we inhabit, we identify with the qualities of this body, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm male, I'm female, I'm with the relations that come with the body, I'm father, I'm mother, I'm son, I'm daughter, and so on, with the social positions of these bodies that come with it, and so on. We identify as the agent of the actions that this body performs. We identify as the enjoyer of the actions that are performed by the body, and so on. And this is all an instance of superimposition, where we superimpose the nature of the self unto the body and unto the things related with the body. And he kind of talks about that in the remainder of the passage you have there. And so what we have to do is we have to, as it were, kind of remove that superimposition. I have to come to see that there is no snake in the room, but there's only a piece of rope that someone left behind. And it's when I have knowledge that there is only rope, the notion of the snake disappears or is sort of is becomes irrelevant, because I know there is only a snake. Now, there's only a rope, sorry. And so in the same way, when I come to see the nature of the self, and its relation to Brahman, and its identity with Brahman ultimately, then the superimpositions that I've sort of been living with for my entire life and countless births before this disappear, and that becomes the state of liberation, where the only thing you have to do is kind of attain that knowledge, which is not an easy thing, of course, as we will see, he argues, but that's essentially what we have to do. If we do not have knowledge, we're in a state of ignorance. And for Shankara, ignorance is not just the absence of knowledge, but it's actually sort of a positive entity. It's the active misidentification of the active sort of superimposition that has to be eradicated through the cultivation of knowledge, through the study of the Upanishads, and the ultimately the cessation of actions through practices of renunciation. That's kind of the basic idea of Shankara, of Shankara's thought. Now, there's a number of things that in this that sort of flow from this, that where Shankara gets into areas that are developed by later thinkers in this tradition in ways that some argue are sort of alien to Shankara's own thinking. And they have to do with then the nature of the superimposition. So if the superimposition, the superimposition of our experience of this world as being a superimposition onto the substrate or the ground of all being that is Brahman, if the world is a superimposition onto that, what is the status of that superimposition in order to not deny the Advaita, the non-dual nature of Brahman? So for the world to be and the world we perceive to not contradict, to not sort of negate the non-duality of Brahman, it either has to be identical to Brahman, or it has to not exist. Any other possibility, and it means you have a duality of the world and Brahman. And it is something that the becomes a focus for the later Advaita tradition, in part because there are some things that Shankara doesn't fully address in this, that leads to some ambiguity in some sense. And this is where we kind of see some of the inconsistencies in Shankara's thought. What you get in the at the bottom of the first page of the handout, you have a passage from the Mandukya Karika Bhasha, the commentary on the Mandukya Karika. And the Mandukya Karika is a treatise that is in some sense a commentary on the Mandukya Upanishad by an earlier thinker who is very influential on Shankara called Gaudapada. And there he kind of, when he talks about the nature of the world and how should we understand the nature of the world and its relation with Brahman, and he says there, if you follow along there, it's a fairly short passage. He says, if one is to be awakened by negating the phenomenal world, how can there be non-duality so long as the phenomenal world persists? Which is basically the question we were dealing with. He says, the answer is this. Such indeed will be the case if the world had existence, but being superimposed like a snake on a rope, it does not exist. There's no doubt that if it had existed, it would cease to be. Not that the snake fancied on the rope or superimposed on the rope through an error of observation exists there in reality and is then removed by correct observation. Not that the magic conjured up by the magician exists there in reality and is then removed on the removal of the optical illusion of its witness. Similarly, this duality that is nothing but Maya and is called the phenomenal world is in supreme truth non-dual, just like the rope and the magician. Therefore, the purport is that there is no such thing as this world, which appears or disappears. And this is sort of something that certain Advaita thinkers after him really pick up on and emphasize this, that the world does not exist. It's an illusion that we superimpose onto the pure consciousness that is Brahman, but the world has no existence. And in some of Shankara's other writings, in some of his other commentaries, he's less sort of idealist, if you want, than you find in this passage. And he's more of a realist, where he says, no, the world has an existence. And it's sort of one of those things, is this Shankara's idea that is his thought maturing or changing as he ages? Or is he kind of taking a particular angle in order to establish a particular truth, or is he just stating this because this is what the Mandukya Karika states, and therefore that's kind of what he explains, and he sort of has less of a personal investment in it. It's kind of, as I said, different scholars look at it in these different ways. Gaudapada, in any case, is strongly influenced by Buddhist thought, which kind of goes more in this direction than you get here, when in its, at least some of the schools, in its understanding of the nature of the world. And so some have argued that it's sort of a Buddhist influence on Gaudapada that we then see reflected in the writings of Shankara. And it's also, as we will see in later weeks, it's a critique that other Vedanta schools also level at Shankara, that Shankara is basically a Buddhist who's teaching Buddhism in with the language of Vedanta, which is not a sort of very accurate assessment of Shankara's thought. But there are certain parallels with the way sort of Buddhist thinkers have been arguing and reasoning, and particularly with Gaudapada and then with Shankara, that allows them to say this. Shankara himself is strongly opposed to Buddhism and doesn't have a lot of nice things to say about Buddhist ideas, and takes them on in sort of some rigor in his writings. But anyway, that's kind of the way some others see it. Now, the idea that develops in the Advaita school in understanding the nature of the world is kind of in a sense, a position in between the two extremes of it doesn't exist and the world fully exists. And it's a very controversial position because what comes to be articulated already by Shankara's disciples is that the nature of the world is ineffable. It's something that we cannot put into words, the ontology of the world. And the term is anirvachaniya, literally ineffable. It cannot be spoken. It cannot be put into words. And it's a term that Shankara himself does not use, but is used by his direct disciples and becomes kind of the dominant way in Advaita Vedanta of thinking about the nature of the world, where they say, we cannot argue that the world does not exist because we perceive the world. I cannot argue that there is no snake because I perceive a snake, and the snake has a response, an effect on me in that I become terrified. Or if I'm a bit more courageous, I rush towards the snake to throw it out or kill it or something. And
how do you spell the word?
A N I R V A C A N I Y A. Anyway, that might have made it worse, but. And so we cannot argue that the world has no existence because we perceive the world and we act in the world. Shankara himself likes to compare the nature of the world to the state of a dream, where once we wake up, we realize the sort of the effervescent nature of the dream and the roles we had in the dream, the identities we had in the dream as sort of being temporary, and we're sort of realized, oh no, I'm not the great heroic prince who went off to fight the dragon in my dream, or I'm not such and such, and so on. But I am, you know, just a normal bloke who wakes up every day in the same room. Now, and so Shankara likes this image of the dream as sort of stating the comparing the nature of our experience in the world to that, and the awakening from the dream as sort of the state of liberation, with one important difference, and that is that the dream is always different, and the dream is not shared. Where our experience in this world is, we share the experience in this world. We perceive the same things in this world, and the world is consistent. Fire is always hot, water is always wet, and so on. And so the experiences we have in this world are consistent, and they're part of our perception. Therefore, we cannot deny the existence of the world. But when we attain liberation and we know the only reality is Brahman, when I realize there is no snake but there is only a rope, then I realize that that reality is not fully real. And so he says, we cannot say that the world does not exist, or later Advaita emphasizes, we cannot say that the world does not exist, but neither can we say that the world exists either. And so the ontological status of the world is not existence nor non-existence, but is anirvachaniya, is ineffable, is unspeakable. It is sort of its own category. It's the nature of an illusion that we cannot sort of grasp it. And Shankara in his writings kind of goes between the two sort of positions. But the way this makes sense is by taking into account Shankara's emphasis on a two-tiered level of reality. And this is something that you always have to be aware of when you're reading Shankara and when you're reading later Advaitins, because it's, if you don't, it becomes very confusing and he really seems utterly inconsistent in his ideas. But what Shankara posits is that there's two levels of reality. We have the conventional reality of our experience in this world, where we perceive the world to be real, where we perceive ourselves to be different from each other, where we operate in a world of duality, and then we have the level of ultimate reality. And the level of ultimate reality, there is only Brahman, there is no duality, and there is no snake superimposed on the rope, and so on. There is no avidya, there is no ignorance. In one sense, Shankara argues that the ultimate reality is the ultimate. That's the actual truth. The reason we see that to be the absolute truth is because once we come to realize this, that that becomes the understanding of the world, or experience of the world, becomes sublated, as it's often said, sort of removed, removed by the knowledge that we gain. When I come into the room, I perceive a snake when there's only a rope, and one of you comes in, turns on the light and says, no, see, there's only a rope, I left this here last night. Then that knowledge of the nature of the rope removes the understanding of the snake, removes the conception of the snake. And so in that sense, the ultimate level, the level of Brahman, is the higher truth. But at the same time, Shankara does not want to say that the reality of the sort of conventional reality, the nature of conventional reality, is utterly false. And so his argument is that as long as you are within the conventional reality, you have to operate within that reality. You have to think in terms of duality. You have to think in terms of multiplicity of selves, and so on. And so what he stated there at the end of that passage on superimposition that we read, he said is, all the scriptures that deal with injunctions, that deal with ritual action and so on, says ultimately, how did he put it? He said, all forms, this is the top part of the second column on the first page, says all forms of worldly and Vedic behavior start by taking for granted this mutual superimposition of the self and non-self known as ignorance. And so do all scriptures dealing with injunction, prohibition, and emancipation. And so, everything that's taught in the Vedic texts, all the Vedic rituals that are taught, everything that's taught in the Dharma Shastras about the social responsibilities that you have, and so on, all of that operates within the realm of duality, within the conventional level of reality. And he says all of those do not have any bearing onto the absolute reality, which is the nature of the self, as ultimately as Brahman. And so, at the same time, he argues that if you are operating within this world of duality, you have to follow those injunctions. You have to act in accordance with the Vedas and the Dharma Shastras and so on, because you still perceive the snake. And so you cannot act in such a way as if there is no snake, because you constantly perceive the snake. And so in the same way, you have to keep acting in accordance with this world in a way that sort of limits your entanglements and so on. And so you act in sort of a detached manner and so on. But you keep acting in this world. Yeah, which is Shankara's ideas are and the teachings of Advaita Vedanta are also often mocked by sort of other schools as sort of basically saying, well, if everything is one as you argue, then you know why don't you eat feces or something? And that kind of that totally denies the sort of the teachings of sort of totally ignores Shankara's teachings on sort of the conventional reality, where if you're in that conventional reality, you just operate in relation to that conventional reality. It's, as we'll see, this notion of the two sort of layers of reality, something that other Vedanta schools have great difficulty with and sort of critique repeatedly as being sort of too cumbersome and so on.
But what does he specifically say about the Maya, about the illusion that basically separates, I mean, Vidya from Avidya?
In one way?
Well, for example, like, what does he say the reason for that is, or how does he describe it or come up with an explanation?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was going to come to that. Yeah, because that's one of the very thorny issues in Shankara's thought that leads to a schism in the tradition after him, which is, if we have those two layers of reality, we have the ultimate reality of Brahman, pure consciousness, untouched by ignorance, and so on, and we have the other reality, which is the reality we inhabit, where we experience ignorance, and so on. How did we get to that? And basically, the way the question is phrased in the tradition is, where is avidya located? Where is this ignorance, this superimposition, where is that located? And there's two options. One is it's located in Brahman. The other, it's located in the individual self, as we experience ourselves now. And both have difficulties with them. If you argue it is in the individual self, it means that my experience of the world is an experience of my illusion, of my ignorance, and which means that you don't have a shared reality, and which means that you cannot sort of, which means, yeah, sort of, you have not the same sort of shared worlds that we exist. And some Advaitins actually take this position, and the most extreme form of that is some Advaitins in the 16th century, in Benares, who argue that the only thing we can say is that I exist, and that everything that I perceive is part of the superimposition unto the pure consciousness that is Brahman, including all of you. So you are all projections of my ignorance. And so it's kind of pure solipsism that some Advaitins kind of go to and say, there is only me, and that's the only thing I can say.
How exactly is that then sort of, reconciled with the advice and stuff? Like, how is it that you could be a source of avidya? Would that not then be introducing a duality? Because then it's coming from you as a separate thing that is not wrong. Does that make sense, this question, sorry?
I'll come to that in a moment. I'll come to that in a moment. Because it's related to the other issue as well, the other side of the argument.
Okay.
And so that's one position, and some Advaitins do take this. The other position is that avidya is located in Brahman, does away with the difficulty of a multiplicity of.
But avidya is not the same as Maya.
Depends which Advaitin you're talking to. Shankara himself doesn't actually use the term Maya very often.
He does not?
No, he doesn't use it all that often. He uses it often in his commentary on Gaudapada's work, because Gaudapada uses the term. But he actually prefers, he generally uses avidya. You have a lot of later authors who argue the two are the same, some who argue the two are different. And some argue that we can posit an individual kind of ignorance and a sort of root ignorance, sort of a universal ignorance, that even when the individual ignorance is removed, the sort of universal ignorance still remains. And that's kind of doing away with the problem that if I attain liberation, does the world then cease to be, and so on, and they say no, because the universal sort of ignorance still remains. The Shankara doesn't quite address this issue at all, and this is where the divergence of opinions arises in the centuries after him. The only place where Shankara addresses this is at some point he argues then, whose is avidya? You know, to whom does avidya belong? And he says it belongs to the person who asks the question, and which is kind of a way. Or at least some later authors see this as sort of a way of sort of dodging the issue by saying, if you ask this question, you are in avidya. Others sort of argue that, no, it's a way of sort of teaching the nature of Brahman and teaching the nature of avidya, because it's something that ultimately cannot be explained. But it's something, I think, that illustrates quite well the difficulties of Shankara's thought, and that is that Shankara, when he talks about these issues, he always talks about these issues from our perspective, and from the perspective of someone who is in this world, who experiences this world, and who has to attain liberation. He argues the state of liberation ultimately is ineffable, we cannot put it into words, it's kind of all his explanation. He's very explicit about this, that is what he's doing. At the beginning of some of his works, he states this. It is kind of, and this is where later Advaita becomes a lot more complicated, because they start looking at it from the top down, as it were, looking at it from starting with Brahman and then working your way down to the world and the avidya and so on, which means you kind of have to deal with the issues of where does avidya come from, how can Brahman, that is omniscient, and pure consciousness, how can Brahman fall into ignorance? That must mean there must be some ignorance that is sort of eternal, but how does that then not negate the duality, the non-duality of Brahman, and so on. And so that's kind of where, if you think of Advaita Vedanta sort of from the top down, you have to deal with a lot more complicated issues than if you look at it from the bottom up, as it were.
I have one last question. Sorry to keep harping on that, but it's something that I right now I'm not able to reconcile. Because there's also, where does this idea come from that Maya, the Mahamaya, is basically Adi Shakti, you know, creating this whole universe so that, you know, as a mirror for Shiva, or to see himself. He does not engage at all, but...
Those are ideas. We'll see them later. They're a different tradition, actually. That's also non-dualist. But that's more radically non-dualist than Shankara. So you have other non-dualist traditions who argue that basically the world is part of the non-dual reality. And that's kind of the Shaiva tradition, non-dual Shaiva traditions. In that direction, that's kind of where they start thinking about those terms. Advaita Vedanta is more complicated in that sense, and it's also, I mean, it's I mean, what I'm doing is kind of I'm highlighting some of the thorny issues in Shankara's thought. And the reason I'm doing that is because we will see these issues lead to, they become important for other traditions who develop their own theology in response to that. But they also, they lead to the wide variety that we find in Advaita Vedanta. Shankara's teachings, you know, as I said, he's a very good writer. He's a very good sort of teacher. And they have, you know, appealed to a large sort of group of people and sort of have led to, you know, the flourishing of traditions. But one thing that you know, in stating this, that I want to sort of make clear is that Shankara's position is, when we look at it now, and Advaita Vedanta is one of the most influential traditions in Hindu thought, and in it's kind of it's it's really a vast sort of complex of sub-traditions and thought, and has influenced a wide range of other traditions. And so we look at sort of, you know, the open textbooks on Hinduism and so on, and it's kind of seen as sort of this is the dominant way of thinking about it. But what I want to, what I sort of want to hint at is that what Shankara is doing in the 8th century or whenever he lived is very radical. And he's really sort of thinking about the Upanishads in ways that have not really been thought of before in the same sense. I mean, he's drawing on a lot of earlier authors, like Gaudapada and a lot of others whom we no longer know. But he's doing something very radical, and he's doing something very original in making sense of what the Upanishads teach, and in developing a coherent theology around that. And in doing that, yes, there are certain issues he does not address, perhaps to everyone's satisfaction. But what he does kind of do is he does kind of present a very coherent picture. But it's a picture that, and this will become clearer when we look at other schools of Vedanta in the following weeks, it's a picture that when you stand in another sort of Vedanta school and you look at it, you kind of go like, I have no idea how to really engage with this because it is so different. It's such a radically different way of reading the Upanishads than I'm used to, and that tradition is used to, and that tradition is used to. And it's such a radically different way of understanding the notion of Advaita, of non-duality. As you were saying, there are other traditions of non-duality that come up, you know, with very different understandings of it that are actually, in terms of the number of schools that take those positions, are more popular than this approach. So keep that in mind, and I think this will become clearer as we look at other traditions that develop themselves in sort of response to the Advaita Vedanta of Shankara, or have their own lineages that some of them go further back than Shankara. But then once Advaita Vedanta becomes popular, start addressing the issues that Advaita Vedanta raises. Because it's what Shankara is doing is he takes a particular approach in the two layers of reality, the notion of superimposition and so on, that when you then apply that to the Upanishads, there's a way in which you can make sense of a lot of the seeming contradictions that you find in the Upanishads. And that's kind of the appeal of him. Let's leave it at that.